You're listening to BizConnect, the show that promotes and connects businesses to do business. Tweet us live at Kent_biz.
Good afternoon on this fine Monday afternoon. Welcome to Kent BizConnect, or BizConnect as we're known now, the bi-weekly business radio show with myself, Martin White, and my fabulous co-host,
Tracy Westall.
Tracy, welcome to the studio. Lovely to see you, as
and
always.
And you.
We've got some super guests with us, as always, today. So let's start by introducing them and getting them involved in the show from the off. To my right, we have the fantastic
Tamara Renshaw from Productivity Finance.
Tamara, welcome to the show. And to your right,
Miguel Calabresi from Blue Rocket Accounting.
Miguel, welcome back. Lovely to have you with us. And Tracy, we've got three parts to the show, haven't we, really?
We have. We've got our fantastic business section, which will take half hour. And no doubt we'll talk about it after the show as well, as we always do.
No doubt. So we've got some of the latest kind of business news in Kent that we're going to talk about. And then we're going to talk to our fabulous studio guests, obviously, as well. We'll start with Tamara, if we may, and then we'll come on to talk to Miguel as well. So, Tracy, what have you kind of spotted? What is your eagle eye spotted out there in the business news this week? What's kind of topical?
Well, I think that the thing that's come to light today is what's been going on with Barclays Bank and the Greenpeace activists.
Oh.
They're out in force and they've targeted branches in Canterbury, Gillingham and Sittingbourne as part of their countrywide protest today. And it's about really the continued multi-billion dollar support they have for fossil fuel industry. So a lot of them have been sort of stopping people getting into the stores, putting banners up, you know, just causing havoc, I suppose, for Barclays Bank.
Good. So what do we think about that? Is that a kind of a sign of the times? Is are kind of businesses much more under the spotlight today, do we think, for their kind of environmental credentials or not?
Well, I think they are. I mean, last week I had a pension review, and one of the questions on my pension review was how did I want my pension to be
invested,
whether it was going to be ethical or, you know. And so it's a really big thing out there in this day and age. And, we should really look about the use of fossil fuels anyway because of what's happening with climate change. But I think that the way we're going, there's probably a lot more potential with more ethical investments than there are in the old-fashioned ways.
Interesting.
Of fossil fuel and the like. So
that made you think, I bet.
It
that,
did,
that
it
question
did, actually.
On the paper, didn't it?
I know.
How do you want your money invested, ethically or just, I just want the biggest return?
Well, to be quite honest with you, I think after the last, you know, couple of years with the attention on this matter being quite rife, the ethical investments seem to be doing better. And the returns are better than they are in the old-fashioned ways.
How
so, it, you know, it's definitely moving forward on that sense. So I think that, you know, I've gone, let's go ethical, see where it takes us.
Yeah. And it's not just eco-warriors today, is it?
No.
It's not just people, you know, stopping you getting in and out of your local Barclays bank. I mean, I think consumers generally are much more conscious, aren't they, about what's kind of going on with the environment. And I think a kind of more and more of us are waking up to the fact that actually we all need to do our bit and, you know, kind of step by step, you know, choice by choice, we can all make a difference, can't we, surely?
Well, yeah.
I think the big corporates, part of their corporate social responsibility is that they need to be doing the right thing. And then when they're starting to work with the SME or the, you know, the little man on the street, then we're measuring them about who we you know, who we choose to go with. So if they've got to publish CSR that supports ethical and green and everything like that, then, you know, Joe Public should really be trying to support that and go in that direction.
As long as the practicalities of that, Miguel, make it possible, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. I think what you don't want to come into a situation where people are forced to become ethical, because then it just gets a little bit of window dressing. So it needs to come naturally to them, and it all goes down, it boils down to the culture of the business and the person who's running it, and the individual buying it as well, because of if they're passionate about what they believe in, it will have more of an impact than it just being forced upon
them.
That's
a really good point there, isn't it? You know, businesses have got to be credible in that space. It's all very well saying, you know, I'm a green business, but actually you're not. No. You know, you're a business that's got energy efficient light bulbs, but you're actually one of the worst polluters, you know, in your particular marketplace. That doesn't kind of wash, does it?
No, it's that's like us changing our name to Green Rocket, right? We're now a green business, but it's not.
It's a good point. That's, I mean, that is totally right. So we need to be able to believe in you as a green business, and that doesn't happen overnight. I mean, for a bank like Barclays to become green is going to take a long time, isn't it? I would, even if they do manage to change their processes and systems, for us to believe it as conscious consumers is going to take a lot longer, isn't it? So it's a gradual process, I guess. But interesting that they've been barricaded today because of their non-greenness, shall we say. Or the perception that they're not green. So,
It'd be interesting. There's no statement from anyone from Barclays today about that. So it'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see what they actually have to say about it.
They're probably at lunch or something.
The Ritz.
Yeah, no doubt. Interesting, really interesting. Now, there's another green thing you've picked up on as well, isn't there, with Manston Airport.
So. Yes. Well, this is something that, obviously, you're not far from Manston.
Yeah.
So, they're looking to do quite a lot. I mean, obviously, this place has been in and out of the news like you would never believe. It was going to be a transport airport where big transport aircraft were going to be landing
Cargo hub.
Then it was going to be like Flybe type of thing.
Housing estate.
But, you know, they seem to be wanting to do quite a bit.
It has now been, I think that there was a public consultation, wasn't there? And I think it came down in favour of the developer River Oak, who wanted to retain it as an airport, initially as a cargo hub, I think, with a view to transport services later on in the day. So so it's proceeding on that basis, I believe.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and they're looking at how to make it more green as well.
So what are they proposing? Because airports aren't necessarily airport and green doesn't necessarily go well together. So I would imagine, in fact, I know what they're trying to do is create, they are going to run it as a cargo hub initially, I think. But the idea, I think, is for them to link with the port of Ramsgate.
Yeah.
Using
electrically operated vessels.
Exactly.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So a new generation of commercial shipping that can move cargo up to the Thames Estuary or, you know, further afield perhaps. You know, on that basis. So take commercial lorry traffic off the roads.
Yeah, exactly.
And use a new fleet of commercial ships that are actually environmentally friendly as well. Imagine that, electric container ships. Can you imagine that?
Well, they do use them on the Danube and on the Rhine and parts of Scandinavia. So this is obviously a method that's been tried and tested. And to us, quite frankly, living in Kent and the road structures that we have these days and how to get from A to B, that seems like a perfect solution.
Let's not call them roads anymore, because they're not roads, are
they're
they?
Holes.
I mean, I've seen more tarmac on the roads of Sicily than I see on our roads at the moment. All the tarmac's been washed away.
Yeah.
And now we've just got puddles and potholes. So
I know, and some of them are quite dangerous, to be honest with you. But you were going to say, Tamara, sorry.
Yeah, I remember reading in the press just before Christmas that the first electric aeroplane landed at Gatwick.
Wow.
And they landed. Yes. They waived all the landing charges because that's what costs the airlines thousands and thousands. And I know that Gatwick, I think it was Gatwick, they waived all their landing charges. Mm-hmm. But how soon or how quickly the other airlines are going to, you know, copy that and, you know, jump on that bandwagon?
That's a really good point. So electric planes you know, now being tested in earnest, electric passenger planes.
But where does the electric come from?
Well, in the case of Ramsgate, it comes directly from the wind farm that sits opposite Ramsgate.
Yeah.
So that's how it can work, you know. And it's all very well moaning about, you know, the blot on the landscape that is the kind of the 100 turbines sitting off the coast. But actually, if it's green energy, you know, that's a pretty kind of small price to pay, isn't it? I would suggest.
Yeah, the UK is well behind the rest of Europe with wind farms anyway. If you drive across Normandy and the Somme and everywhere, it's just, you know, fields and fields and miles of it. Yeah. We're well behind.
Well, Vattenfall, who make all the wind farms, most of them that kind of we have offshore, are actually a Swedish-owned state company. So that's how kind of more advanced they are in their thinking than we are over here. So it's not being run for profit, in other words. It's being run for sustainable energy.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really exciting, isn't it, all this
stuff? It is. It's going to be interesting to see what happens, with all of this, because I think it's definitely, you know, we do have a waterway, and a lot of the waterways in the UK were no longer used for what the purpose they were built for.
Yeah.
I mean, even up north and the canals and everything, they used to be so busy because there was no road structure.
Yeah.
And yet these things are still around, and if we can utilise them on this premise, then we should definitely give it a go. And if they can do it in Germany and Scandinavia, why can't we do it along the Thames?
isn't it interesting at the moment, you know, with coronavirus and kind of, you know, the news focused on that at the moment, where all of a sudden employers are saying to their employees, work from home.
Yep.
Don't worry about it, just work from home. You think, well, hang on a minute, if it's that easy, why aren't we doing that anyway? You know, why are we obsessed with, you know, millions and millions of people getting in their tiny little cars every day and sitting in traffic jams, trying to commute to a place of work, when the employer, as we're seeing at the moment, is quite able to turn around and say, do you know what? Just work from home.
Yeah.
You know, why aren't we doing that anyway?
I don't know. I think a lot of it is down to the fact that I don't really know whether or not it's a trust issue or... You know, I think a lot more people are a bit more, you know, I know when I work from home, I get a lot more done.
Yeah.
A lot more done. And I could be sitting there, and it's terrible because I could sit there till 8 o'clock at night going, oh, my belly's rumbling, I need some tea. It's 8 o'clock in the evening. But, you know, people can be a lot more proactive being at home because they don't have all the other, you know, distractions. But then again, you know, work, if you're one of these people that has a job that can work from home all the time, then it can be a very lonely place. So you've really got to find that happy medium, I think. But I think a lot of, not job sharing as such, but sort of desk sharing. Mm. You know, I know a few firms in London that, you know, some secretaries go in on a Monday to Wednesday and then another secretary use that same desk on a Thursday and Friday because they're only part-time. So, you know, there's lots of things that can be, you know, utilised.
I mean, not all jobs can be done
remotely,
clearly. But, you know, we are a services-focused economy, you know, and, you know, things like financial services, for example. I mean, you know, your job tomorrow, you know, yes, you go to meetings, you meet with clients, but actually a lot of what you do is, you know, is helping clients complete application forms. And, you know, you don't need to be in a physical office, you know, with other colleagues to do that, do you? You could do that anywhere, pretty much.
No, I mean, I've got a home office, and, you know, as Tracy said, it can be a lonely place at times, but... You know, if I'm not on the phone to a funder or to a customer, I'm out seeing customers or meeting accountants and introducers and so on. So you've just got to plan your day. Yes, if you're stuck in the office for 3 days in a row and you've got nobody else to bounce your ideas off, then yes, you know, you probably go a bit stir crazy.
Yeah.
But, you know, I am on the phone literally from, you know, all day. And as you said, it gets to 7 o'clock and family's calling for their dinner and time just runs away with it.
Yeah.
But I think apart from anything else, you know, commuting... It's dehumanising, isn't
it? Commuting is awful.
I mean, and it probably makes you that much less productive because you begrudge the fact that, you know, you've had a nightmare to even get to your place of work.
Well, when I worked in London, I used to get up at 4 a.m.
You used to get the green...
I used to get the coach up to London.
Green Ferry, was it?
King's Ferry.
King's Ferry.
Yeah. Catch the first coach out and... If there was any traffic on the road, then you were just sitting there. But at least it was warm and you had a seat, so it wasn't too bad. We used to travel sort of anything between 3 hours a day, there and back. Summer holidays we used to love, and then they started digging up the road, so then we didn't like it anymore. And the invention of having like a TV app to download TV programs was a godsend.
Yeah.
Because you felt as if you ended up having your evening on the coach.
Mm.
But even on the trains, there's always delays. You know, some of the trains that come out of Cannon Street are not long enough, so people are standing or sitting on the floor. And it is demoralising, but also it takes its toll. Mm. And you are absolutely so tired that how you can concentrate. And by Fridays, I felt like a zombie. Mm. So that was it. I needed to get away from that lifestyle because I wasn't being proactive and I wasn't being able to apply myself the best of my ability because I was tired all the time.
So we've got the government's kind of stated objective of zero net carbon by 2050. We've got the government's kind of stated objective of you won't be able to buy a petrol or a diesel car by 2035, I think it is. We've got the government's stated objective of you won't even be able to have a new a gas boiler fitted in your new home after 2030. So they've got all this kind of big picture kind of targets and what's actually being done to help facilitate it, you know.
I think that there are some... I mean, I was talking to somebody we both know, Michelle from Discovery PA, and she got me on this app called Zoom. Mm. And I said, what's that? And we had a phone call, and then it was a face-to-face on my phone. It was really weird. Mm. And then I could put things on spreadsheets up, and I could actually have a proper meeting. She was at home, I was in my office, and we did what we had to cover on that meeting by this phone app. So there are ways and means of doing it.
Absolutely.
And a lot of businesses out there are multinationals and have meetings with all different, you know, all around the world. Mm-hmm. So these things can be done. Yeah.
But my point is, you know, somebody, you know, needs to do it, you know, and, you know, whether that's the government. I mean, we were talking about the budget, you know, that we've got coming up, obviously. Is it next week or the week after?
The 11th.
You know, what's going to be in the budget, you know, to help businesses and to help consumers make this transition. You know, I mean, if there's nothing in the budget, you know, these are just kind of hot air kind of targets, aren't they, and numbers that actually are never going to be delivered because nobody's actually doing anything about them. So I'm going to be looking out for that in the budget, and I'm, you know, let's see what's coming down the pipe.
I think it's going to be quite. I mean, we've got a new chancellor, we've got a new government. Post Brexit, it's got a lot to cover off. So, as you said, it's going to be a real. You know, it's either going to be all or nothing.
Yeah,
it's going to be a real. Mm. You know.
I think you're right. I think, and that's what we need. You know, we need. We don't want a wishy-washy budget. Like, you know, which is what we normally get, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, a kind of reduced tax, kind of keep everybody happy, kind of budget and bumble along. We need something more fundamental than that, don't we?
Mm. And business, you know, whatever decisions they do make, we need them to be made now. A lot of the time, they say that we're going to make these big changes, corporation tax or any sort of investment, but it doesn't happen for like 18 months' time.
Mm.
And people have, you know, they've lost the momentum by then. Businesses have, you know, forgotten about what happened at the budget 18 months ago. You know,
they're
small
focused
businesses
on,
want action now. They want to know that something's going to happen in the next 2 months or so.
Mm. Mm. But I am heartened by that article about Manston and, you know, thinking to the future, because commercial shipping, again, you know, as well as kind of, you know, commercial flights, passenger flights, freight flights, everything, you know, are obviously huge, huge polluters. And I think, you know, going back to the kind of the conscious consumer, you know, terminology, I think we are all individually becoming more aware of, you know, this problem.
Mm.
You know, as a climate, we are getting warmer. The reason we're getting frequent floods is because the climate is warming up. These used to be one in 20-year kind of events.
If that.
Now we're getting them, you know, I think we've had four major kind of catastrophic events on this level in the last 20 years.
In the last 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Realistically,
well,
we've had four storms.
Three storms
in 4 weeks. Yeah. And
In other words, I think collectively we all want to do something about it.
Mm.
So, you know, let's harness that and, you know, government and business and, you know, let's work together and make it happen.
Yeah.
It's all going to boil down to cost, though, right?
Of course.
Everything green is more expensive. Mm. You think of electric cars, you talked about the electric planes.
Yeah.
My first thought was, well, no one's going to pick it up because it's cheaper to make the alternative at the moment.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's seeing what comes from there.
You're absolutely right, because it can't be mass market if it's going to cost more.
No.
Because people can't afford it.
But then if you look at the fair trade products, when that was first released, yes, everything was a little bit more expensive, but then you were providing an income for a family that had no income. Mm-hmm. They were setting up farms. You were putting water filtration systems and building schools through that whole project and scheme. Mm-hmm. And since it's been going, a lot of the fair trade wines, they're the same price, if not cheaper. The bananas, the fruits,
sugar,
the coffees, mm-hmm. the chocolate,
yep.
they've all come down in price and have a competitive pricing level mm-hmm. with all your normal range of stuff. Mm. But it's whether or not that you're actually going to pick up on the fact that, I know I'm actually going to go and buy this fair trade bar of chocolate because my money is going to go back into that cocoa farm
mm-hmm.
and generate more income for that family and that workforce on that farm. And I think that, you know, the more and more people buy into it, it's taken time, but it's now come to the point where it is a fair and even balance.
And it is a recognisable identity logo now, isn't it? I mean, I saw it on the sugar. We're at Kent Space, by the way, aren't we? This is our studio here at Kent Space in Ashford. And I saw it on the sugar in the kitchen. You know, I noticed it immediately on a simple black and white bit of packaging, the Fair Trade logo.
Yes.
So, and you're right, it's just taking time for that to actually mean something, I think, in the marketplace. And I think, you know, when it comes to sustainability and environmental, you know, products and services, the same thing
will happen.
Yeah.
It will happen.
It will get, but you're absolutely right, Miguel. If it's more expensive, it's very difficult for it to be adopted, you know, to be adopted rather by the masses, because, you know, people haven't got the money to pay more for stuff like that, you know, whether it's energy, clean energy or electric vehicles or, you know, whatever it happens to be. So that's where the government, for me, need to step up. Yeah. And that's what I'm looking for in the budget. I want to see their commitment, you know, in terms of putting their hand in the pocket and making some of this stuff happen. Yeah. But on the same side, if employers can turn around to staff and say, do you know what, while this coronavirus, you know, is a problem, you can work from home. Well, why aren't you doing that anyway? You know, that for me just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. But I do think the current, going back to this coronavirus, because everybody's talking about it, it's like if you look at the amount of people that have actually caught it, that are in hospital, in comparison to everybody else that might have an odd sniffle, might have an odd cold, wash your hands. You should wash your hands anyway, otherwise that's just filthy. But, you know, people always get colds. People always get ill around this time. And it just seems to be such a big thing at the moment. It's just take care of yourself. You should anyway. Mm. And, you know, make sure that, you know, you don't cough and splutter over anybody, which you should do anyway, even if it's just a mere cold. Mm. And I just think that, through the media, it's been it's every time you watch the news, how many more people, 36 people, 48 people. Mm. And I just think to myself, more people are run over by a car a day than they are that have caught this, you know. Mm. But there's none, you know, it's just really crazy. And I just hope there's not too much scaremongering going on about this. But, yeah, you should always look after your health anyway. Mm. That's a foregone conclusion.
But it does seem to be snowballing, unfortunately, doesn't it?
It does,
now?
It does.
Schools being closed and,
The panic is going to, you know, kill people more so than the actual virus.
Exactly?
Well,
exactly.
You said it's
a panic
earlier.
Pandemic rather than, you know, the actual virus itself. People are, you know, just going to the shops trying to find a sanitizer.
Well, that's what you were saying earlier, wasn't it? You tried to buy some and you couldn't even get some. Yeah.
And the ones that are, you know, where you can buy it, those businesses are trying to profiteer from it, which is a disgrace, really.
Yeah.
You know.
Good old bar of soap, warm water, wash your hands.
But we do need to move on, and we have been rabbiting about business news in one way or another for 28 minutes. But just to finish on that, I also saw an interesting article talking about transport and airports and things like that. Could Boris Ireland be back? ? So, and I think we'll leave it at that, because obviously, you know, they, in theory, the third runway at Heathrow has now been thrown out.
Yeah.
So, you know, where does that leave us? Does that leave us back where we started 5 years ago with Boris Island. Who knows? But very exciting, potentially, isn't it? Yeah.
Good old Greta Thunberg.
Yeah. And with the latest...
Go, girl.
Well, exactly. With the latest generation of electric planes tomorrow. Yeah. What an exciting thought.
I'm not sure if I'll go transatlantic, but...
Well, no, you know. No. Oh, well, dear me.
Maybe you wouldn't want to be the first person.
Yeah, I'll fly to Manchester first and see if the plane stays up.
Yeah, I guess if you drop out the sky from 30,000 feet, it doesn't matter where you're flying, does it? It's not going to be good.
No.
So, anyway, that's not going to happen, but it's very exciting, and we shall keep our listeners... informed, I think
it'd be
yes,
good.
It's really, really good. Anyway, what we're going to do now is we're going to play a little bit of music, which will hopefully serve as an introduction to our first guest, and hopefully it won't be too tenuous for people this time, and they should be able to make the link. So here we go.
You're listening to Biz Connect. Tweet us live at Kent_Biz.
Welcome back, everybody. For the educated listener out there, that was obviously Pink Floyd and Money, which I think, Tracy, is a suitable introduction to our next guest.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is.
So, Tamara Renshaw from Productivity Finance, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And I think it's fair to say, Tamara, that you deal in all things money when it comes to business.
Yeah, all shapes and sizes, you name it, we've got it covered.
Fantastic. But I'm going to take you back a little bit to your first career, shall we call it, which was as a chartered banker.
Mm.
So what does that actually mean? What is a chartered banker? I mean, we hear the term merchant banker a lot, and obviously it's a much derided term in reference to, you know, perhaps investment bankers in the city. But what exactly is a chartered banker?
Okay, it's an accreditation which a credit specialist or an underwriter or indeed a frontline relationship manager should have, and it gives them the ability to understand all the accounting that goes on within small businesses. Acts as a credit assessment, so you're learning credit skills on how to underwrite a deal, you know, analysing the risk profile of a business, should we be lending this money or shouldn't we. So it's just really it starts off with the foundation level right up to sort of, you know, the gold standard, if you
right.
like. So
you're
stages.
You're an old-fashioned banker then.
Yeah.
In many ways, yeah. Because today I don't get the impression that, I mean, in my experience, whenever I deal with my bank, I don't get the impression that I'm dealing with anybody that's gone through any kind of formal training on that level. And in fact, you know, really they're just middlemen who are, you know, taking my request for, you know, something, passing it up the line to somebody probably like you that sits in an office somewhere else,
yeah.
who then makes a decision on whether they're going to lend money. Is it fair to say that the industry has been kind of dumbed down
right.
to a level?
Yeah, I think you're right, Martin. The you know, good bank managers are becoming a rather rare commodity on the high street.
Mm.
You can go into any of the, you know, the big five high street banks now, if there is a branch on the high street still, but where there are, then yes, you will probably be looked after in the first stages by a relationship manager who may not have been properly credit trained. However, at the same time, we've got a target to lend.
Mm.
So they are having to send it off further up the line, and then it might go further up the line again to a credit committee, and that's why it takes, you know, some of those banks, you know, such a long time to get back to the cutter.
So there's no local autonomy anymore, or very little from what I can gather, when it comes to actually somebody making a decision.
I think in my day, the frontline relationship managers were given the, we were all given a remit, could be up to 100,000, 200,000 or more, where you could give it the once over and you'd get a flavour of whether you can proceed with that customer or not. And yes, you might have to get it rubber stamped ultimately by your boss, but yes, you had the ability and the, you know, you could look at a business and say, yes, we're going to lend to this company or not. And you were able to then relay that to the customer. There's nothing worse than a small business applying to their bank manager, and then it takes three weeks to get a no. Nobody likes a we call it a slow no.
Yeah.
They want to know, am I likely to get credit? And I need to know now. And if not, I need to move on to the next.
To the next alternative,
you know, where I'm going to get the money from.
So when we
Something
talk about...
worse than that, sorry.
Go on, Miguel.
Is when they offer you the money and then it turns into a slow no.
Oh, really?
And they're the ones saying to you, we can lend to you, we can lend to you. And you think, OK, I'll go ahead with it. And then it turns out being a no. That's
frustrating. Yeah, it's managing their expectations from day one, because as a... You know, we're all in business here, and you want to grow your business and everything. You do not want to be able to have to wait 3 weeks before you want to commit to whatever you want to do to grow that business. An opportunity presents itself, and you need to act now. You don't want to have to wait for 3 weeks for the decision.
Yeah.
That's apart from then completing all the paperwork, and doing the legals and security if needed. So I think old-fashioned bank managers of my generation were properly credit-trained.
Yeah.
And some of the seminars and presentations that I do, we talk about the old way of, there's a, you know, methodology of how we look at credit that has kind of died a death now. And with fintech companies born probably sort of 6-7 years ago, with the likes of Funding Circle, who have come along, which are great if you're a good business and you're thriving and you're making money. You can apply today, get your money at 4 o'clock. It's that
quick.
And the algorithms that they've got built in are really the computerised version of what we did with a pen and paper and a calculator. But it's for the weaker businesses where the computer says no, that you need somebody on your side to fight your corner and come out and see you. And, you know, as a bank manager, I looked after a portfolio of customers. I understood the daily challenges that a small business faced, you know.
You were a bank manager as opposed to a relationship manager. Which for me is just all it's done really in the, you know, in the kind of traditional retail banking industry, is just commoditize what all those guys do. You know, I mean, we don't need to name names. We know who they are. Some of them you couldn't even get in their branch today. But, you know, for me, there's no value in what they in the services they provide anymore, mm. other than the fact I need to have a bank account and, you know, I need to have it somewhere. Yeah. But I don't really see any value being added in the way that, you know, a relationship with you in the past, you know, you'd have been able to look at my business plan and you'd have been able to say, Martin, had you thought about maybe doing this? Or, you know, as Miguel mm. does with his clients, you know, you were much more of a partner than, you know, just somebody that was effectively doing an admin function, I think. That's the impression I get.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some businesses would actually, you know, call us a stakeholder in their business mm. where it's not just when you want to borrow money, it could be £5,000 or £500,000. It's every day when you can't pay your payroll at the end of the week or mm. you can't pay your rent. Mm. You look at your bank account each morning mm. and see what's coming in and what's going out. Mm. You know, they want to be able to ring up their bank manager and say, I'm in a fix.
Yes.
Can you pay my direct debits today?
Yeah.
And, mm. you know, now, probably in the current day, there's mm. not a lot of banks who could probably say yeah. yes or no and support that.
That's a really good point, because you've just yeah. written us a great blog about, you know, what do you do if you can't pay your VAT bill?
Yeah.
And in the past, I could have had that conversation with you because you knew the fundamentals about my business.
Yes.
Today, if you go to a bank, you know, your bank, and you say, I need some very short-term credit and I need it now, the chances are they're going to say no, aren't they? And yeah. where does that leave you?
Yeah, I mean, it's knowing the customer. Mm. You know, a lot of towards the end of my career at the bank, we were, you know, sending customers up to, you know, the direct channel, or who was probably based offshore somewhere. So it was difficult to, you know, you'd looked after customers for so many years, mm. and then all of a sudden they're starting to, you know, get taken away from you because mm. they're either not earning the bank enough money mm. or they're not borrowing anything. But, yeah, you need to know your customers and mm. where the next money is coming in, mm-hmm. whether it's a seasonal business or whatever, because, you know, VAT bills do land mm. at the most inconvenient of times.
Mm. Yep.
And it's, you know, some funders like have...
quarterly, for example.
Yeah, but exactly. I'm laughing because you know exactly when they're coming.
Yeah, but you're saying that, yeah. you know, you borrow money to pay your VAT bill, not always because you've got mismanagement or yeah. poor management. You right. know, an opportunity might have presented itself the week before, which mm-hmm. you just had to jump on, mm-hmm. and you use the cash Crikey. That you were going to use to pay your VAT yeah. bill, or some of your debtors mm-hmm. have not paid.
Yes.
So as long as there is a legitimate reason and it's mm. not through poor cash management, mm. then there's every reason a funder should be supporting you to pay your HMRC obligations.
And actually, it could be something as fun, you know, as basic as, you know, you have a big deal that comes in right at the end of that quarter that you charge VAT on, that then goes into the mix, you know, that's, yeah. that's then actually due,
yeah.
you know, within 6 weeks' time. And, you've got to kind of pay the VAT on that invoice mm. that actually isn't necessarily going to be delivered for another, you know, you're not going to realise the cash from it immediately, in other words. So
yeah, you don't have to commit to a 12-month loan on a VAT mm. Facility. You know, you just take it out for a couple of months until you get your VAT return come
yeah.
through
yeah.
a quarter later.
So that was then, mm. and this is now. So mm. obviously you've left that world behind, and I can understand why you would. It must have been very frustrating for you at the end.
I think towards the end, it was when, obviously being an RBS, we went through the troubles back in 2008, and mm. you know, I was lucky because I was on the Williams and Glynn branded mm. side of the business, mm. where the customers were very loyal and had been with us for 30, 40 years plus, so they were very understanding. But yeah, you're right. The time came where mm. voluntary redundancy came up, and I decided to sort of leave the corporate world behind. Mm. And this is when the whole fintech and peer-to-peer was born, so I decided mm. to
Great time
join
to
one
be.
Of them.
Yeah. Fantastic. So in terms of where you are now, you are Productivity Finance.
Yes.
So there's a group of you, I believe, who are all ex-banking people, professionals.
Yes, mm. there's Synergy Finance, which is our franchisor, if you like. There's lots of networks out there which mortgage advisors and IFAs all use. Commercial brokers, there's a lot of us, probably 200 or so up and down the country. We belong to this franchisor and the benefit of being a member of that is you've got instant access, literally on day one, to whole of market funders.
Right.
So if you can imagine, if I was independent on my own, I'd have to go to Barclays and Lloyd's and Funding Circle and get on board with all these different funders, and it would just be a complete headache. So by being a franchisee, you've got all the support that they give you. So, you know, it's not just about being funder-facing and having that provided for you on day one. But, you know, we all get stuck on deals and we send messages out to each other saying, I've got this tricky property deal. Who does this or who doesn't do it? Or, you know, it's in most of us work from home, as I said, which is quite a lonely place sometimes. Mm. So bouncing ideas off each other and sharing deals, if you like, is what it's all about.
And we're talking, because, I mean, one of the, I think, the biggest problems with the traditional high street banks, coming back to them, is startup finance.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can't borrow money off a bank that you've never borrowed money off before because you've got no credit history.
Yeah, it's a chicken and egg, isn't it?
That's the reality of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even if you have got some kind of banking history with them, it may not, they may not view that as being relevant in the context of what you now want to do.
Yeah.
So, you know, startup finance is a massive challenge, isn't it, for a lot of people?
It is, and there are government platforms around which do support startups. As long as you've got a business plan and a projection forecast for at least a year, then, yeah, there are platforms out there which...
So the Startup Loan Programme, which is a government-run initiative.
Yeah,
And how much can you borrow through them? Is there a ceiling on that, or...?
Yeah, so you can borrow anything from 500 to 25,000.
Right, so it's 25 grand is not insignificant, is it?
No, no, it's if you're... Yeah, and if you're opening up a shop, we've done quite a few recently for shopkeepers opening up, tradesmen who are working for a big firm going out on their own. They needed tools, van, you know, stuff to get on the road with.
Mm-hmm.
Web designers, all sorts of, not sort of lifestyle businesses, people who have treated it as a hobby and then are beginning to then branch out on their own and they actually want to go into business. So it's ideal for those types of companies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how much is that going to... going to cost you as a loan recipient? What do they charge for that?
So the startup loan company have a fixed rate of 6% per annum, no fees, and it's a fairly quick and easy process.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you've got a decent business plan that's been put together professionally, we can present it to them and we usually get a decision within 2 or 3 days, and then funds can be drawn down almost straight away after that.
So a lot more than you'd pay on a kind of personal loan through your bank, which might be 1% above base, for example.
Martin, that was about 20 years ago.
Really? Oh, I thought personal loans were very...
I don't think they're that cheap anymore.
Oh, no. Oh, I thought they were.
Add a zero. And
Oh, my God. Because I know business loans, I mean, if you went to a high street bank and wanted a start-up business loan, they'd be quoting you something like 12%, probably even higher. So, okay, so personal loans are kind of up at double-digit as well, are they?
Yeah, I'd say personal facilities, if it's unsecured, are going to be at least 8-9% plus.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay. So actually, they're incredibly good value, aren't they? Startup loans, by the sounds of it. So,
and when you say startup, because some people start their business, they've been going for 12 months, and then think, I need a bit of a cash injection because I now need to move out of wherever I am into somewhere bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So, when you say startup, for those listeners out there, how long does the actual startup mean?
Okay. Good point, yeah.
So the government-funded funders out there, there's a few of them, they state that it's 2 years.
Okay.
So obviously if you're on Companies House, they can see when you're incorporated. It's a bit more difficult for them to prove themselves, you know, if you're a sole trader.
Yeah.
But it's 2 years.
Right, okay.
So businesses, they can even be pre-revenue. They might have done a lot of research and development and it's taken them 12 months to get to market and now they need the funding. So as long as they've been actively trading for 2 years, less than 2 years, then they would qualify for the government funding.
Okay.
That sounds like the obvious first port of call to me then.
Exactly. So say for instance you've got a business that's now just gone over that 2 year period. Because I'm trying to build up like a stepping stone type of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, where do you go
Where
then?
Do you go from there? Yeah. What availability is there?
So once you've got 2 years of filed accounts, then, I wouldn't say the world's your oyster, but, you know, we've got a whole host of funders that are then ready to listen. So you've got a proven track record. You've got a set of accounts that's proving profitability. If you're breaking even or you've been a bit of loss making, obviously a lot of capital expense in the early years, as long as you can demonstrate that now, you know, in the next 9-12 months, things are going to turn around and take off, then, you know, most funders should listen. So it's looking at those existing accounts that have been filed looking at the balance sheet, looking at whether whatever the product or the services that you've brought to market, is it working?
Yeah.
As a business owner, if you know, they say that most businesses fail within the first 2 years, and as a sensible business owner, if it's not working, then you know, might be a time to call call it a day.
Mm-hmm.
2 years
so
is quite long.
If you go. You know, like the fintech route, so someone like a funding circle. What's the actual process of applying for a loan through that? I mean, I seem to remember people having to go through a process where they had to secure a certain amount of money by a certain date, and otherwise they wouldn't get the kind of the money at all, and they had to shoot videos and things. And is that crowdfunding? Is that something completely different?
That's crowdfunding.
Right, okay.
So, yes, it's usually where you get a bunch of people who are literally, the entrepreneur would go online with their products, whatever it is they're looking to bring to market, mm-hmm. and look for, private investors to get money together. So peer-to-peer funding, which is what Funding Circle is a much more... In the early days, the way peer-to-peer funding works is that you'll have people like ourselves putting money onto an investor's platform. Could be 10 grand, could be 20 grand, could be 1,000, because, you're not getting that much interest rates on deposit accounts from any of the building societies or banks. So when peer-to-peer funders were born, that was the best return that you could get. Okay. You could get sort of 6% plus.
So is it like anonymised angel investing? Is that a good description?
Yeah. And in the early days, you would a bunch of, you might have to wait a day whilst your loan that you've applied for gets funded. Mm-hmm. But things have moved on quite a lot because they've grown quite rapidly. And them now. There's quite a few other peer-to-peer funders on the market.
So there is a pot of money. And I guess as someone that invests in that platform as an angel investor, you can decide, I guess, business sectors, categories where you'd like your money to be spent. Is that right, or does it not work like that?
I understand that to be the case. Some people can say, well, I don't want to invest in that area or that sector of business. I'm more interested in this sector.
If you wanted to be green, for example, you could say, right, only green businesses, that's where I want my money being invested. So
I think in the early days, Funding Circle were saying that, yes, you could choose what type of investment, what type of businesses you wanted my investment to be lent out to. Mm-hmm. And there were different sectors, longevity of companies that have been in business, that sort of thing. It's kind of moved on quite a bit from that now, and it's just wholesale funding. So as an investor, you don't necessarily know who's borrowed your money, and they leave it down to the experienced underwriters within that funding company to make the decision, the credit decision for them.
And is that business plan focused again, or is it an application form? How does it actually? What's the process?
Well, it's very quick. So yes, these funders do have a direct channel, but of course most people in business like to use the services of a broker because they've got, we know exactly where to go. Applying to five or six different funders that's not easy. It takes up a long time. So we would go out and see the customer or speak to the customer over the phone, get to know what they're looking for and why, get their accounts and everything, write up a credit paper, and then submit it all online. So it's all done online these days.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you'll get the computer says no on occasion. Then you either move on to the next one or go back to the customer and find out, well, what went wrong here, or tell me about this so that we can, try and overcome that. And then it gets funded literally within about 48 hours. Mm. So they'll do all of the underwriting. There's built-in algorithms to help the underwriter assess the risk of that business, and that's on sector and longevity and maybe they're overly lent in that particular area, which has had a hit, so they sort of turn that area off and or put the interest rates might be a bit higher in that area. So it's just a very quick way of getting funding these days.
So it's largely automated by the sounds of it. I mean, based on algorithms and, I guess they've got ratios programmed into that and...
To a certain extent, forecasts. And, a certain extent. But they will have a credit committee who will have final sign-off and say, this is a good risk company to lend to.
Yeah. Mm. Now, that's borrowing money is kind of one thing, whether you're a startup or you're trying to scale up your business or whatever. But there's so many finance products out there for businesses as well, aren't there, that you can tap into. So we've got invoice financing. Yes. You know, I mean, Tracy, your business is all about cash flow and credit management. And I guess, you know, invoice financing is kind of one route potentially for businesses to get that money in on day one, as opposed to having to wait for it on day 45. So, how do you decide what's right for a business in that context? What isn't right for them? How do you kind of, you know, look at affordability and what's best value for a business on that level? Do you just use your experience or?
Yeah, most customers come to us and they think they want a loan. Mm. I need 50 grand. I need 100 grand. Mm. And there could be fixed high payments that come with that, depending on the term of the loan, when actually a revolving credit facility is what they really need. It could be, you know, they've got a cash flow crisis because of VAT that's come in, or a debtor hasn't paid, or they've
gone bust.
They've won a tender. You know, they've tendered for something with the council or with a big corporate who then put sort of 60, 90-day payment terms on them. So, you know, they think they've got this kudos and this really good contract that they've just won, but in reality, they've got to wait 90 days to be paid.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, they've got to pay their subbies every Friday, they've got to pay the rent or the mortgage and all the other overheads.
So what exactly is a revolving credit facility? What does that mean in terms? Is it like an overdraft that you can dip in and out of?
It's exactly that, yeah. Right. So because invoice finance is a form of revolving credit where a funder will take a charge over the debtor book, the customers who've got to pay you the money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in a sense, they're auditing your customers to see whether they're good for the loan. And they will put a credit limit in place. And it's very good if you've got a growing business that's scaling up rapidly. If you wanted to have a 50 grand facility and then all of a sudden your business grew and your turnover sort of doubled in the next year, then if you had a loan, what would you do? You couldn't fund that. But with invoice financing, as your turnover grows, you know, your credit limit with them will grow.
Mm-hmm.
But revolving.
And how do you pay for that then? How is that? How do they levy the charge on that?
Well, there's a few charges. Mm-hmm. It is a little bit complicated for some businesses to understand, because you'll have what's called a service charge. Then you'll have the margin, which is the interest rate, if you like. There might be some unutilized charge that they levy as well. But if you don't like invoice finance, then a straightforward overdraft facility, the same as you might have with your bank, is also available. So a lot of customers don't know that you can have an overdraft with a funder, and it doesn't have to be your own bank.
Yep.
So if your own bank says no, or you're maxed out with your current bank, then there are funders out there which will give you a 25, 30 grand, whatever it is you need, whatever facility, and you just draw down on it. So each day, so you're only paying interest on you know, the utilised funds.
So this is invoice finance as opposed to invoice discounting. Is that something completely different?
Yes, invoice discounting is where you perhaps want, you want to keep it confidential. Perhaps you don't want your own customers to know that you're financing the facility. Some customers, charities, for example, they don't want their, if you're dealing with charities a lot, I've got one client who works with only charities. They don't want them to know that they're, you know, have got a finance facility in place to cope with, you know, the way they operate. There's all sorts of facilities for businesses that require money, and it isn't always a business loan, a bank loan. It could be a whole range. It could be asset finance.
Mm.
You know, if you're buying a fleet of vehicles or plant and machinery or a whole IT kit for your office, you would probably put it on asset finance. You wouldn't put it on a loan.
Right. Okay, so what is asset finance exactly then, as opposed to a loan?
Asset finance, another word is hire purchase, perhaps, or leasing.
Mm, yeah.
Mm.
I see.
Yeah.
So you don't buy it outright necessarily,
You can hire purchase, you know, if you go into your local dealership and you buy a car, you put it on HP for 3 years.
Yes.
And then at the end, you can choose whether you have a balloon payment to repay, hand the car back, or get a new car. Mm-hmm. So you can do the same with kit and plant machinery in the business as well.
Yeah.
So it sounds to me like there is almost an unending number of options here for businesses to kind of to think about. But actually, half the battle is going to be, you know, even knowing
it's knowing
what's
that
out
there. It's there, exactly. And the big thing is that a lot of businesses panic because they go, I haven't got no money in my bank. Mm. What am I going to do next?
And they go to the bank and the bank says no.
Yeah, and you want a quick fix. And sometimes a quick fix isn't necessarily the right fix for you.
Mm.
So it's making sure that, you know, businesses out there realise that there are all these extra other facilities to help a business. And I always say, go and seek advice from an expert.
Right. So that and brings us back to Mara, because it sounds to me like, you know, you've got your finger on the pulse when it comes to all the available options in the marketplace. And as you say, your whole of market as well. Yeah. So you're not tied to a particular lender either, which is the important thing.
And also, Tamara's just told me she's coming along to the CICM Business Finance Conference on the 17th of March down at the Grand in Folkestone. See, we've got another expert going
on-site.
To be in the room.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's people who are going to be there that are going to give you all this fabulous information.
But also at the moment, you do, am I right in thinking you do a free borrowing and finance review for businesses as well? So you will even sit down with a business for an hour or so, have a conversation about, you know, what that currently looks like, what their need is, and you can kind of offer advice.
Yes,
on that basis.
Yes, we've always got an open door to businesses who want to talk about what finances they have in place already, which haven't been reviewed maybe for a year or two. So, yeah, we call it the business borrowing review.
Yeah.
And it's just to make sure that what they've got in place already is the right product and right term, the rates and everything. You know, margins, interest rate margins are fairly low at the moment within funders. So if you took a loan out with a bank, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, chances are that now's the time, just as you would do with your own house mortgage.
I'd say the same thing,
review.
Don't I? Yeah, just review.
Yeah. Good. And that costs nothing. I mean, you're happy
anything.
To meet with people on that basis.
Well, I mean, you need to take that up, don't you, really?
I would have thought so. So on that basis, how do we get in touch with you, Tamara? What's the best way for people to contact Tamara Renshaw and say, Tamara, I need to sit down and discuss and have a borrowing review for my business? How do I do that?
So we do have a website, productivityfinance.co.uk. I'm obviously on the phone. 07741 478221, and on email as well. So contact me and we can carry out the review for you.
Perfect. Fantastic. Well, for now, thank you so much for coming in.
It
certainly opened my eyes. And Miguel, I'm sure you must work with third parties, you know, as a firm of accountants, to kind of offer clients the best advice on that basis as well. So, because you know, you are the expert and we clearly aren't. So that's fantastic. What we're going to do now, I think, Tracy, is play a bit more music.
Oh, goody.
By way of an introduction to Miguel.
Miguel, what have we got for you today?
And we will see you again on the other side of this.
Switch on the TV, we may pick him up on channel 2.
welcome back to the show once again. Tracy.
Yes.
Over to you, because I know that's one of your favourites.
Do you know what? I do like a bit of Bowie.
Well done.
I do. Well done. Yes.
And it's not the 80s, obviously. It's the 70s.
I know, before I was born.
Yeah, 1972, I think that was. So without further ado, let's introduce Miguel from, and here is the link, Blue Rocket Accounting.
Hello.
And Miguel, I know you have many strap lines that you use, but give us an example of one of those.
One of them would be Our Mission is Your Success.
Helping your business reach for the stars.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's fair to say that the theme for how you promote your business is all about helping me get into orbit, explore the universe, and kind of and go from there. So I think it's fair to say you're a firm of accountants that's slightly different to the norm. Is that right?
Oh, we try to be. Yeah. It's accountants can come across quite stuffy and boring, or that's the stereotypical of them, but that's what we try not to be.
Right.
And when we was talking about earlier about working from home and stuff like that, that's when I was thinking to myself, God, could you imagine being locked in the room by yourself doing accounts every day, all day? That's one of the benefits of coming to an office, right? To have that interaction.
Absolutely, absolutely. But the way you talk about business, you talk about business in the context of, you know, not doing numbers at the end of the year, but actually helping business owners fundamentally understand the numbers that are driving their business and that are ultimately, hopefully, going to achieve what it is that they want out of their business at some point in the future.
Yeah, exactly, because success is different to everybody. So everybody has their own goal that they want to achieve, and we're here to help you understand your numbers and how to get to that goal.
Right.
I'm sure Tamara will back me up, but one of the biggest things that we see is that businesses go for funding too late.
Mm-hmm.
They're at a point where they really, really, really need it, and then everybody knows that, and it's actually, well, no, you're not going to get it.
Yeah.
So the idea of keeping up your numbers up to date and having monthly management accounts, say, right, to see where you are,
mm-hmm.
see how you compare to the targets you set at the beginning of the year.
Right.
Allows you to spot that need for funding 6 to 8 months before you need it,
mm-hmm.
when you're in a healthier position cash-wise. And then if you do apply for it, banks or lenders are more likely to say yes.
So the fundamental starting point is where do you want to be?
Yeah,
I guess whether it's in 20 years or in 5 years, it doesn't really matter. It's what do you want from your business? And those aren't necessarily easy questions to answer, are they? I mean, if I think about my own business, could I put my finger on exactly what I want that to be in 5 years' time?
No, but you could phrase it with, "Would you want any employees?" That's quite a good question to ask a business owner, because that gets them really to think about, actually, will I be expanding or will it just be me? And the answer is okay if I don't know or I'm not ready at the time. But what you're doing is planting the seed that is a fundamental change in business. When you actually take somebody on, your business changes, and that's when you need extra help to know where you are, know if you can afford it, make sure the wages are going to get paid on the Friday. And that's where planning really comes into its own.
So do you see yourself in your own business premises, you know, employing 5 people, you know, whatever it might look like? You know, what sort of, paint a picture of what you see the business looking like in a future.
Yeah, it always starts. So from a startup business, essentially the first question is how much you need to take home, how much you need to live. What is the mortgage? What is the bills? What's a bit of fun money that you can go out and enjoy yourself with? Okay, that's our starting point.
Right.
Will you be happy with that, or do you want more? And if they want more, then there's the steps. Actually, okay, how much more?
Yes.
How much more can you do yourself? Or do we need to bring somebody else in? Do we actually need a premises or not? Do we need vehicles? Do we need assets? They're all questions that come up as the business grows, because of, from starting up at day one to 2 years down the line, it's a different conversation depending on how the first 2 years went.
That sounds like sort of bottom-up planning. Can you look at it the other way and do a top-down and say, right, I want to retire in 8 years' time. I want a pot of money equivalent to X. I have a business vehicle that I want to get me there. Can we reverse engineer the business from the top down as opposed to the bottom up? Is it possible to do it that way?
Yeah, definitely. Right. The way to approach it is there's a product that's not ours, but it's called an E360.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what that does is a lot of business owners will say, I haven't got a pension, or my business is my pension. Mm-hmm. And then when you come to actually value it, it's mm-hmm. not worth as much as they need or they would like.
Yes.
So what the 360 starts at is, okay, when you want to retire, what type of lifestyle do you want?
Mm-hmm.
And then, so what other assets have you got? What cash have you got? What pensions have you got? What are they likely to pay out? And there's always a shortfall, which is down to the business.
Yes.
And then we say, okay, your business needs to be worth X thousand by this date for you to achieve what you want.
Right.
So now we can work backwards and say, well, what is it worth today?
Yes.
And of course, evaluation is more of an art than it is a science, because of a business is only worth what someone's prepared to pay for it. So, but as long as we've got an idea of what it's worth today, then we can put a plan in to say, okay, it's worth 100,000 today. Mm-hmm. We need it to get to 500,000 in 5 years' time.
Mm-hmm.
What do we need to do to get to that 500,000?
Yeah.
And it will be then things of looking at taking on employees to be able to expand the business. It will be looking at getting funding in place, but knowing that before. So we can apply for the funding 6 months before we actually need it, so we're in a better position. It's knowing what's around the corner, basically.
See, that is so important, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Where do you think most entrepreneurs, what camp do they fall in? Do they fall in the latter in terms of their... you know, their planning and their kind of diligence on that level? Or are they people that have fallen into business as a kind of lifestyle proposition? Or are they creative people that have come up with ideas but actually don't know how to kind of structure and plan a business to get them to that point?
I think it comes down to your definition of entrepreneur. If you say entrepreneur, who's the first business person that comes to your mind is what I would say to you. Who is it?
Richard Branson.
So... Richard Branson, more than likely, when he started, had wealthy backing. Maybe didn't know too much about his numbers, but could go to the right person to do that. With the greatest respect, your self-employed accountant wouldn't be an entrepreneur in my eyes, because it's just him working out of his room.
Right.
So it's a different level of conversation to it.
That's interesting.
Yeah?
So it means different things owners, to different people.
There's business owners, there's lifestyle businesses, there's business owners, and then there's entrepreneurs.
Right.
And it's where you fit in that scale, because it's a different conversation to be had with each of those.
Right.
The true entrepreneurs, they're bouncing around all over the place, because that's what they are. They're onto the next idea, they get something started, they get all the process ready, and then they walk away and let the people, the experts, run that business and make money from it. The business owner is someone that's really good at what they're doing, but then try to expand a little bit, take on some more people, so they've got a bit of expertise, but now they're just taking a step into the business world by trying to delegate, put some controls and processes in place and systemize their business. Well, your self-employed person is, you're just working for yourself, which none of them are wrong, because they all serve a purpose to that to that person. But that's
but I guess it's
having them right questions asked, dependent on where you fit within them categories.
Yeah.
And also, it's important to decide what you want to get out of it at the end of the day. If yours is a lifestyle business at the moment, where do you want to be in 20 years' time when you come up to, you know, in your 50s or your 60s? Do you want to retire? How are you going to do it? You know, and you might decide, well, actually, I might either franchise it out or all these other aspects. And having somebody on your side that understands your business can give you really great advice. And, you know, and if your accountant's that far forward thinking, then you've got a great accountant there.
I think also over the years in the past, the accountant's job was to just do your tax return at the end of the year. Now, management accounts and, you know, your key performance indicators and so on is such an important aspect, whether you want to borrow money or not. So I'd say at least 70 or 80% of the companies that we come across file their accounts at the 9 months past their end of, end of year. So when they do want to borrow money and they haven't got any management accounts, you know, a funder is expected to make a decision on on accounts that are 18 months
historical.
Old. And anything could have happened in that time. So we work closely with accountants who, you know, are literally with their customers month in, month out,
mm-hmm.
giving them the information that they need.
Yeah.
But what I'm hearing from Miguel, and this for me on a personal level is the fundamental difference between having a set of management accounts and having a set of management accounts with purpose.
Yeah.
Because without the thinking about where you're trying to get to.
Mm.
They're still just another set of numbers.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, yes, it's real-time numbers as opposed to 9 months-old numbers, but they're still just numbers. And you know, it's without that kind of context in terms of what you genuinely want from your business, that's yeah. for me, is what adds the colour, if that makes sense.
Definitely.
Mm.
Yeah, and then if you can write down what you actually want from your business, and if that's in 5 years or 10 years yeah. or whatever you break it down to, if you can scale it right back down to a 12-month operational plan and just have 3 key headings, it could be something like, we're aiming to achieve this amount of sales, or internally we're trying to get everything systemized. Then you can prepare more detailed actions off the back of that, so then you know as each day or month goes past, if you're doing something that drives towards those actions being completed, then you're going in the right direction.
Right. And you as a business, do you hold your clients accountable on that basis?
Yeah.
Is that how you work?
Yeah, so if we sit with a client and they've got budgets and forecasts, yes. and they have aspirations for them, then every decision or every conversation we have with them is this moving towards us, our end game?
Yeah, and what would you do that? Will you review that kind of quarterly or...?
It's a real mix. There's monthly ones, quarterly ones. Some of the smaller businesses look at it 6 monthly and sometimes even annually, depending on where they want to go with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's always good to just have a starting point, though. So if most businesses start annually and say, this is where we want to be at the end of the year, if they can see the value in it, then they'll start to move towards quarterly.
And monthly. Do you, as an accountant, do you encourage business owners to understand, not fully be experts on, but to understand what those figures mean?
Yeah, because the toughest job of us as accountants is is getting the numbers produced, but also asking the question, does this actually reflect reality? And that's a question that I always ask clients, is saying, this is what your numbers are saying. Is that what's actually happening in your world, or are the numbers just completely way off?
Yes.
Yeah.
So they need to understand how we get there why we're getting there.
I mean, I know that because obviously we've got all these cloud-based systems now, and everyone has access to the accounts, the accountant and the business owner and whoever does, you know, the bookkeeper, whoever it is. And when I see some of our clients, the real big amazing thing that blows my mind is nobody talks to one another to ask them specific questions. And going back to, you know, obviously, you know, an accountant will do the year end 9 months later. I met a really lovely accountant at Networkers. I said, you're a historian because you're looking at what happened and not what's happening today.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, some really good accountants out there are going, right, I need to do more for my clients because it's no longer just a process. And it's really nice to see that there are some great businesses like Blue Rocket that do right. We want you to grow. We want you to be stable. We want you to be really good. And what is your end game?
Yeah.
And it's good expert advice as well.
Yeah. I mean, I must ask you, you know, where you stand on business coaches, for example, because, you know, the number of business coaches that, you know, that I come across who they've never really owned a business.
Yeah.
That's fundamental number one. They don't actually apply what they talk to business owners about in their own business. If they did, they'd be a lot more successful than they are. But also they tend to be focused on objectivizing everything to the nth degree, you know, and like having, you know, monthly this and monthly that. And I'm thinking, you know, how it's just not possible. You know, you would spend your entire working week focusing on objectives and KPIs and not actually doing any business if I followed your advice. And so where do you kind of stand on that, and where do you think you kind of plug the gap that they don't, sort of thing? How are you more practical?
So the first thing I would say is that
we're not business coaches.
Right.
We couldn't be there hand-holding every day. We can be on the phone, but our core skills are finances. And we don't want to stretch away from that. Yes, I can talk about number of clients you've got, average fee you've got, average invoice, and if we increase that, and if we increase that, the effect. Because they're all numbers-based.
Yes, yes.
But that's not what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not what we want to do because finances is what we're good at. So that's one clear thing to say. We do work really well with business coaches, but I'm a bit like you in the sense that... So I have a business coach myself, but every business coach... Well, the business coach that I work, have built a business, have sold a business, have lost a business.
Right.
They've been through the work.
Been there and done it.
And it's not your car salesman last week who was kicking a tyre and now is a business coach this week because they've managed to get a framework that they can follow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Every business is different, so it needs that uniqueness to it. So having a coach and having someone accountable, holding you account is a great idea, and it should be done. It's finding the right person to do it.
But I think you're selling yourself short, Miguel.
I think so too.
Because, you know, we were obviously talking at length before we came on air, and, you know, I mean, I'm starting a new business. You're going to be my accountant. But what came out of that conversation for me was... you know, it was the ideas that from me just talking to you and you understanding where I'm coming from as a startup business. The value for me isn't just in the numbers and you telling me what the numbers are saying, but actually it's you adding your thoughts and ideas to the mix at the same time, albeit in the context of, you know, on a kind of revenue level. That's what, you know, that's what that would mean on a profitability, on a margin level. But I think, you know, you're much more of a sounding board as well than just purely an accountant that will help me understand what my management accounts are saying. And what you were talking about in the beginning in terms of sitting down with the business owner and helping them understand and create a clear vision of where they want to get to. That for me is fundamental, and it's so difficult to do on your own.
Yeah.
But because of what Tamara said, most accountants only want to see you when they've got their fee-earning compliance work to do. It's very difficult to bounce that off anybody either. So that, for me, is, you know, it's more than just...
Sounding board is... Yes, we are, and there are phone calls that we take all the time and have chats with clients all the time about what they should do in a particular instance. I think we're with the business coach... it was more leaning towards if you need finance or someone like then we'd bring in an expert.
Yes, of course.
If you need trademarking, for example, we'd bring in an expert. If you need help with sales and marketing, we would bring in an expert. We wouldn't try and do it ourselves.
No.
Or we wouldn't have a product or a service that we can just call upon and and say, well, this is what you need to follow.
Yes.
The whole idea of our conversations is to spark them, to identify the needs and say to people, actually, look, there is an opportunity here that you're missing.
Yes.
We can bring some, or we can put you in contact with somebody that can help you with that area.
Mm-hmm.
And see, this is where I think you find you're making yourself fall short by saying you don't, you know, you do all of these things, which is fantastic, but there are many accountancy practices out there up and down the country that don't do any of that.
Mm.
Don't do it at all. And it's, I'm your accountant, I'll just do this, that and the other, tick a few boxes, done. That's how much VAT you've got to pay. That's how much corporation tax. This is how much you've got to pay on your PAYE, whatever it is. You know, I'll do your payroll for you and everything else. Now, we always say, I've always turned around and said, you know, when you start a business, there's two fundamental places you need to go to: a bank for a bank account and an accountant to do your books. And that's where most businesses think that they can get help. Now, Blue Rocket will turn around and say, well, yeah, we know somebody that can help you with that, which is what they should be doing, accountants should be doing, because there's a lot of things that collaborative work with other people and other experts, your clients are going to feel really comfortable picking the phone up and going, Miguel, I've got this issue, I'm not too sure about what I should do, what do you think? That is a really good selling point for your business, because there's not a lot of businesses that will take their accountant as their first call in a crisis.
But I think for me, you know, fundamentally business is about going on a journey.
Yeah.
And, you know, what we were talking about in the beginning in terms of setting a destination, setting the context of that journey is actually fundamental at the beginning. Mm. And that's where most accountants have no involvement whatsoever. Whereas, you know, what you're saying is, you know, we need to start with that, with you as a business partner, in order that when we meet you on a quarterly basis or a monthly basis or whatever it is, we've got some context to the discussion, and we're not just producing numbers for the sake of producing numbers because we've got a compliance job to do at the end of the year. That, for me, is the fundamental kind of part that's missing, if you like, in that relationship with most accountants.
It's having a passion as well, I think, for their client, for what they do.
My idea of a good accountant is when things aren't going right, the business owner can pick up their accountant and say, what's gone wrong here? And actually, you know, you're close enough to the business to be able to identify, well, there's a problem with your profit margins, or you're just growing too quickly and you're overtrading. So, you know, the expression turnover is vanity. Profit is sanity.
Cash is king.
Cash is king. Cash will always be king. Yeah. But an accountant needs to be close enough to their account and with their customers to be able to offer that real live advice.
Totally.
That if you're looking at accounts monthly, you can, you know, foresee what's going to happen, you know, six months down the road, and you need to make these changes now.
Yeah.
Your profit margins aren't strong enough, or you're not ready to move into premises. Let's just hold back.
It's about being proactive with what you've got and understanding. That's why I say, you know, understanding the numbers. You don't have to be an expert. That's why you've got an accountant, because that's an expert in that area. You know, about your funding and everything else, there are experts to help you out. But I think fundamentally SMEs need to understand just a little bit of information about these things so it's not so scary. And that's the big thing. And people get scared. They go and buy a bucket full of sand, stick their head in it. And, you know, we see too many businesses that won't go and ask for help. And it's having dynamic and proactive accountants like Blue Rocket. We should have more of that. We really should have more.
Well, for me, it's fundamental. And as I say, on a personal level, it's about having that. Mm. It's about helping shape the vision.
Yeah.
So that when we have a conversation, we know what we're looking at numbers in the context of you know, that for me is the fundamental thing, rather than just looking at numbers.
At numbers, you've always got to compare to something, otherwise they're meaningless.
Right? Yeah, yeah, and exactly.
And whether that's to a budget, whether that's to your end game vision, whatever it is, there's got to be a comparison But we talked about, you talked about exiting a business as well. Having management accounts and in a proof of, like, history of you setting budgets and achieving those budgets and forecasts will make your business more valuable in the end.
Of course.
We've got a couple of sales going through at the moment. One of them's got nothing, one of them's got everything. And you can see the difference in multiple when it comes to selling the business of the one that's got everything, including little things like having a board minutes. And just filing them away.
It is these small things,
Guys, we could talk about this all day, but we can't, because we've run out of time again. And we always run out of time when we could just talk for hours and hours. Miguel, how do we get in touch with you?
You can call the office on 01322 555 442. Or we have got, there's a Supply My Business page on the blog where there's you can leave your contact details, and there's a questionnaire that we send out, which allows us then to produce a report to highlight some key improvement possibilities in your business.
A business benchmarking
And it's
report.
Literally just a yes or no questions, so it doesn't take less than 5 minutes.
Superb, superb. Right, on that note, I am going to have to close the show. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks' time, but for now, from everybody...
Cheerio.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. To offer,
nothing much to take. I'm an absolute beginner. But I'm absolutely sane. As long as we're together, the rest can go to hell.
Channel 2 Talk.